Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. Recently, a newly organized North Carolina advocacy group known as Interfaith Creation Care of the Triangle held an online gathering to discuss the dire environmental crises and destructive economic inequality that plague the modern world. The featured speaker at the event was Duke University Professor of Economic History, Dirk Philipson. In a fascinating talk, Philipson explained how the modern economy and our understanding of what constitutes economic success have been greatly hindered by the tool economists and politicians most commonly use to measure growth, a metric known as gross domestic product, or GDP. Philipson, who's also written a powerful book on the subject called The Little Big Number, joined me by phone to explain his argument. Well, Professor Dirk Philipson, welcome to News and Views. It's really great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
How are you surviving the crisis? I ask this question of all our guests. It's extraordinary times. I hope you're faring okay in this bizarre world that we're inhabiting right now.
Well, strangely, I think okay is probably the last word that would come to mind. It makes us humble, and it is a moment full of contradictions, it seems to be, because I think I probably have never enjoyed a spring more than this one. I'm super privileged, so I can sit in my backyard and sit in the sun and do my Zoom meetings from there. There are many, many moments of reflection and personal connection that are much more intense than things that we have experienced lately. On the one hand, and on the other hand, you, of course, are so aware of all the misery and all the suffering that is happening in the world. So okay is really not capturing it as much as it is really a moment of intense contradictions and extremes.
That sounds about the best description I've actually heard of a situation that so many of us are experiencing. Thank you for that. Obviously, we wanted to talk to you about some important subjects in this moment in which we're sort of contemplating a lot of basic questions about how we organize ourselves as a modern society and a modern economy. A lot of big issues on the table right now, and that's an area in which you have a lot of experience as an economic historian. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about your work and your teaching at Duke University and in economic history?
Yeah, so we're actually currently running a design sprint where we brought together young people from mostly Durham, but also from around the world. We have about 70 or so participants in helping us try to figure out how to create a resource hub for people who would like to build a better world, what we call a well-being society, and to see what tools people would need in order to, you know, translate idea into action. So my work is largely focused on understanding, first of all, the history of capitalism and sort of trying to figure out what the operating logic and the values and the ideologies behind the system are. My particular focus is on what I consider to be sort of the big elephant in the room that rarely gets talked about in any kind of substantive way, which is economic growth. If you open up the New York Times or Washington Post or Boston Globe or something, what you often find is that from the right to the left, across the ideological spectrum, pretty much everybody is in favor of economic growth. And in fact, economists tell us that if we don't have it, then we are in crisis, and we call it a depression, and bad things happen. So that's the one storyline. And the other storyline that sits somehow as is completely disconnected from it on the other side of the front page is the story of that natural scientists tell us, which is that we are in crisis. The environment is in crisis. The biosphere is in crisis. We have climate change. And the core reason for that is economic growth, right? So that one side of the paper tells us we can't survive the lack of economic growth, and the other side of the paper tells us we can't survive economic growth. And the two don't really talk to each other. And so that's sort of the core of my current research and work, is to see whether we can maybe possibly think about an operating logic that gets us away from this sort of structural imperative to grow and gets us from more to better, from quantity to quality, allows us to create a society that is focused on well-being of people and planet rather than just simply extraction and growth.
It makes such obvious sense. It's remarkable that we haven't talked about it more frequently and explicitly. One of the issues that you've identified in your research, of course, is this metric that we use to measure growth, and that has for so long been held up as an ideal, a goal for us to expand, and that's GDP, or gross domestic product. You called it in your book, The Little Big Number. Talk to us about where the heck did that come from, and how has it come to be associated with progress in society?
It's a remarkable thing that I, as a teacher, really stumbled across when some of my more brilliant students ask about how we measure performance of the economy. And, of course, I was tempted to give all the sort of pat answers. And in the process of doing so, I realized how bad these answers are. But it also raised questions very quickly in my mind about, you know, how is it possible that there is a metric that is universally adopted, right? There is, with the possible exception of Bhutan and North Korea, not a single country in the world that does not measure economic performance exactly the same way we do. And so, as a historian, I simply could not think of a single other big, broad idea or concept or set of values that has ever been adopted by people around the world. So I said, you know, I need to research this, and there must be, you know, dozens of books. This is so centrally important to the functioning of our society, and I realized there was none. And so I set out to write this book, and it took me about 8 years to put it all together, and I think it's to this very day the only sort of social history of the metric itself. Where did it come from? How did it spread around the world? So for the listeners who may not know this, just very briefly, and you laid this out in your little article very, very nicely, I think. The problem with the metric is that it is a pure, indiscriminate output metric, that it doesn't differentiate between good and bad. It doesn't differentiate between output and outcome. So, you know, the best event for that metric is, you know, me becoming a smoker, an alcoholic, having a divorce, and crashing my SUV into some other car, for the simple reason that it just simply measures every market transaction, financial transaction, and doesn't care at all about outcome. And the other problem with that, of course, is that practically everything, in fact, Robert F. Kennedy said, it measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. And so what did he mean by that? It doesn't measure freedom and democracy. It doesn't measure the ecosystem. It doesn't measure the tree unless you cut it down and turn it into lumber. It doesn't measure good relationships and good marriages, because a good marriage is literally terrible for GDP. My divorce would be so much better because I need a new refrigerator and a new apartment and a lawyer and a therapist and on and on and on. But it's a really terrible measure. Now, why do we have it? We have it, it literally was invented in the midst of the Great Depression. And the challenge in the Great Depression was that economists literally had no idea what was going on, and they didn't have metrics or data sets were reliably telling them, you know, about levels of investment, for instance, or just simply numbers of unemployed. So when you read history books today that talk about what the Great Depression looked like, or what GDP was like in 1890 America, for instance, this is all retroactive information. At the time, it just simply flat out did not exist. So at the height of the Great Depression in 1932, there was a Senate panel that was asking the Secretary of Commerce as to how many people were unemployed in the United States, and he said, I have no idea. And so what people were essentially trying to do is gather essential data about where the economy stood, where the crisis points were, what was happening to businesses, what was happening to levels of investment, and so on. And that data set, of course, was absolutely essential to bringing about what we now know as the New Deal, right? Because the New Deal was essentially an attempt by the government to jump in where private businesses did not invest, to jumpstart investment and to create jobs for people that they would then use in order to make income, that they would then use in order to generate demand in the marketplace.
So there were good motives, apparently, when they were originally trying to come up with this metric.
There were not only good motives. I think that it literally brought us from the dark ages in terms of economic data gathering into the modern era. And it is a set of information that is absolutely vital to have. So my critique of GDP is not that it is information that is not valuable. My critique of GDP is the same critique that the very father of the Fed had in the first place. His name was Simon Kuznets. And he said, you know, please, people, do not ever use this set of information as a well-being or welfare metric. But that's exactly what we ended up doing, right? So the measure became the value. So we tried to measure what we value, and now we value what we measure. And we essentially left out everything else, right? So the only thing that we could measure is hardcore things that are transacted in the marketplace. But we did not know how to measure things like happiness or democracy or freedom or ecosystem services, right? And many, many other things that are obviously very important. And so now we literally are guided by this very truncated, very limited, ultimately very stupid metric, because it's just simply the only thing that we could all agree on. It's sort of the lowest common denominator.
We're talking with Professor Dirk Philipson of Duke University, and Professor Philipson's talking to us about gross domestic product, what he describes as this stupid metric that we use to measure well-being in our economy. And the other aspect to it, in addition to its crudeness and stupidity, is that it requires, or at least we've had this assumption that we require GDP growth every year, which, when you put in exponential growth over time, leads to a physically unsustainable situation, right?
That's correct. So, but I want to make it even more complicated for a second, if I may. And that is, you know, when I worked on GDP and I worked on, you know, the literally hundreds of initiatives around the world by the UN and by the EU and some American government initiatives too, to come up with better metrics, because people generally agree now and people generally understand, experts understand that it is a very crude measure. And so I literally thought for the longest time that just changing the metric to a better metric would maybe possibly get us on a better course. And I have now sort of tentatively at least concluded that this is not so, because it turns out that GDP actually is a quite perfect measure for the logic of capitalism. You can think about capitalism all you know, whatever way you want to think about it. I usually think about it as the best and the worst thing that ever happened to human beings, both at the same time. But whatever your ideological viewpoint, capitalism never claimed to be about anything other than creating more capital, right? Profit, growth. Capitalism in itself does not care about how we think and how we govern ourselves or how we interact with each other or any of those things. And so capitalism is about turning more and more things into commodities and allowing us to transact in the marketplace more and more of everything. And of course, this is exactly what we're currently experiencing in the world, that there are millions of people out there who literally go to work every day doing nothing other than trying to come up with a new gadget, a new app, a new thing to sell. We're turning friendships into therapy sessions. When I divorce my wife and then hire her as the caretaker of my children, then suddenly I'm making a contribution to GDP and well-being. And so this is what scholars would call the commodification of our lives. Everything turns into a commodity. And we see it in language, too. We begin to talk about investing in friendships, and we're talking about branding and marketing. We're talking about utility and utility maximization. And all of this is sort of the economization and commodification of life. And GDP captures that, indeed, extremely well. That's exactly what GDP measures. What this moment in history right now, of course, so clearly demonstrates is that is literally not what matters in life. This is not what gives people meaning in life or value in life, or it doesn't define relationships. It doesn't define the quality of our body politic. It doesn't do any of those things. And so the best people who defend the system can say is that it is a reasonably good proxy for well-being, right? That wealth and having more cash in your pocket in essence gives you more opportunities. And of course, that also no longer holds true, because today we now have reached a point where creating more economic output actually creates more poverty than well-being. It ravages and rapes and pillages the land and people, and it just is much more devastating than it is doing good.
So we talk about the idea of measuring well-being in society in a different way. What are the practical implications of that? If we somehow shifted away from the whole idea of measuring well-being through GDP and through economic growth, What would be the practical implications? How would society change? Can we even imagine what it would be like without sort of this dominant capitalist theme that runs through all of our lives?
My first comment as a historian would be to say that for sort of, 99% of human history, we didn't have it. So right. Obviously it's possible. So this, not just the sort of almost exclusive focus, but the structural imperative to grow is historically a very new thing. So clearly it is possible without it. Now, how would that work? And that's an enormously complicated question to which, only a fool would give a simple answer. But to give you just one example, one of the things that we could do is actually take the logic and just simply make it a fully developed logic and not a truncated logic, namely do what I call full cost accounting. So not just attach a price to that which we can buy and sell in the marketplace, but to everything. So a friend of mine from Australia, for instance, did this with his research team. He's an environmental economist, and he did something really interesting. He looked at what is the value of ecosystem services. What are ecosystem services, right? If you look at the tree provides oxygen and cleans water and refurbishes the soil and provides habitat for, a gazillion bugs and, any number of other things. Or what are the ecosystem services of bees? They pollinate our flowers and they pollinate, a lot of vegetation that if we didn't have bees, we would have to do ourselves. So he just simply did a sort of back of the envelope kind of estimate of what are the annual ecosystem services in the economy and came to the conclusion that it would probably run up to about twice as much as what all human beings combined produce every year, except that we don't pay for it. And so that's a big example. Small examples are that GDP, for instance, has consistently undercounted what traditionally has been the care and nurture work of women, right? So if my wife stayed at home taking care of the children, it does not at all account it in GDP. And yet it is absolutely essential work in the society for it to have a future. When we now stay at home and take care of elderly parents, again, same thing, right? So what would happen if you actually accounted for all these services? And then lastly, what economists call negative externalities, right? So if I buy a gallon of gas, I only pay for the money that it costs to extract the oil and refine it. I don't pay for the pollution it causes. I don't pay for the child that will have respiratory problems. I don't pay for any of those kinds of things. And full cost accounting, which is simply put a price to all of those things. Scholars at Harvard have figured out that a gallon of gasoline, if you did full cost accounting, would be $18 a gallon. At $18 a gallon, you can imagine, you don't have to change anything else. You can leave capitalism just as is. At $18 a gallon, I guarantee you, people would suddenly be very interested in walking and biking and electrical cars and refurbishing the economy to become defossilized. That's just one example of how you could deal with, as a practical proposition, how you could try to create a different society by just simply changing GDP from a purely market measure to a full cost accounting measure.
Our time is limited. We're coming to the end of our conversation with Professor Dirk Philipson of Duke University. I guess as people want to learn more about this subject, Professor, can they go to your website, read more, read your book?
Well, read my book is always a good start. So one of the organizations that I'm working with that I have a lot of hope in is the so-called Wellbeing Economy Alliance, and you can go online and go to weall.org. This is a group of people from around the world that founded this organization in the fall of 2017, and they don't really have all that much in common except that they all fully understand that an exponentially growth-based capitalism is a suicide pact, and that we should really refocus on well-being of people and planet. And so there are a couple of basic ideas here. One is that we shouldn't privilege people over all other beings. We should embed society in the ecosystem, and we should embed economy in the society rather than the other way around. That we are all equal around the world, that we don't have the right to hoard and exclude the vast majority of people around the world from our wealth. So it's basic principles like that. And we're trying to create sort of a global movement that just basically networks and helps people to work on every level, from the community all the way to the national level, in efforts to create something that is more in service of people and nature, including things like universal basic income guarantee or universal basic services like healthcare and things of that nature.
It sounds like a long overdue project, and we wish you all the best with it. We hope our listeners will check it out. Again, you can remind us of the website where they can learn more.
Type in Wellbeing Economy Alliance and it will come up.
We look forward to growth, if you will, in this effort you're pursuing. We wish you all the best with it. Thank you for your fine work.
No pun intended, right?
All right. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news about COVID-19 at the State Department of Health and Human Services website, ncdhhs.gov. You can also check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, this is Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.